on time, and I open the House Committee on Environment and Land Use. Present are Representatives Rosenbaum, Greenlich, Ackerman, Dennis Richardson sitting to my left, and we welcome all of you this morning. The first portion of our meeting will be the organizational part on our agenda, and we need to take a look at our committee rules and adopt those. So the chair would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I need to do that. Okay. And we will officially open the organizational meeting.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'd like to begin by moving the committee adopt the committee rules as presented.
Is there any objections? Hearing none, the committee rules are adopted. We move now and we'll close the organizational meeting and move on to our informational meeting. And at this point, I'll open the meeting to any committee member who would like to make a statement or tell us something about themselves. This committee, I think, has a great advantage in that none of us really have had a lot of experience dealing with the issues that this committee is going to deal with. And I see that as an advantage and have felt that the first several meetings that we have will deal with educating the committee to the issues. Coming in at 9 o'clock this morning, we'll have Representative Close, who was the chair of this committee during the last session. She'll kind of give us her synopsis of the issues. And then we're going to have various state agencies and various interested individuals and organizations also speak to us, again, to give this committee an education before we ever try to start hearing what those issues are. Any committee member like to say anything? Diane, you look like you...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I certainly am looking forward to learning about land use issues. As you have said, I do not have a huge background. I'm a third-term member and have never served on an environmental committee, but I have high interest in the issue. My constituents care a lot about environmental quality, but I also have a background as a union member, so I know that having a strong economy that creates jobs and protecting the environment are goals that can work harmoniously. So I'm looking forward to working with you and the other members, and ready to get to work.
This committee welcomes you. You'll be a very valuable member. Representative Greenlee.
Mr. Chair, I'm honored to be on this committee with you and my good colleague, our vice chair. Land use planning and the environment are very critical issues for my district, House District 33, which spans from urban to rural. We have a bridging district, and the land use issues in the very high growth House District 33 are very critical. The special issues that I'll be, I think, particularly interested in are the questions of managing growth, the question of the health effects of environmental degradation because of my background, and some particular concerns around Forest Park, which is a major resource in my district. So I'm very, very happy to be here.
And we welcome you. Good morning, Representative Richards.
Good morning, Chairman. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm looking forward to working on this committee. I've been reviewing the Department of Land Conservation and Development's Oregon statewide planning goals and guidelines, and the interesting aspect is how the implementation is taking place. And I come from Southern Oregon, a district that has as its primary concerns farming, forests, and fishing, and so I'm very much interested in what we can do to help assure that implementation of lofty goals is not overburdensome to the people.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Zauner, good morning. It's nice to see you here this morning.
Yes. I apologize. I had to have my cup of coffee.
We have coffee here.
Well, yes. Yeah, the last meeting I was in, we didn't. Good to be here. Even cities have problems with land. And Woodburn right now, we're trying to move three companies in there to go to work and to simulate the economy. And they have a little hang-up on some land use, and so we all have our concerns, and I'm just happy to be here, and hopefully I can contribute and not screw up the committee members too badly. Thank you.
We welcome you. And Representative Ackerman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is my sort of my sophomore year in the legislature. It's rather amazing to think that in 2 years I've served this legislature for six sessions. This is my seventh. I'm a lawyer. I'm still practice law. I've been admitted to the Oregon State Bar since 1963. A very small part of my practice was in the environmental and land use area. It was not something that I was expert in. However, I have taken a few cases to LUBA and have been involved in a few local zoning and land use problems. I do have, as a resource to this group, a publication put out by the Oregon State Bar CLE series, and I'll bring it at the next meeting. It's rather, and Mr. Richardson knows what I'm talking about, it's a rather thick book, but it contains all of the case law, all of the synopsis, all of the goals and implementation procedures and what have you. So it may be just as a resource for committee members. It's really a highly indexed and a fairly easy read. So I'll just provide that as a resource to the committee. And those of you that need to want to use that publication, just let me know. Thank you.
Well, I know Bob and I have had some good conversations during the last session on energy and and the environment, and we're going to find you a very valued member of this committee, Bob.
Thank you.
Representative Doyle is our seventh and final member of the committee, and Dan, we just got right down to you here just for any comments or
you're late, Dan.
I'm trying not to do the same thing to him now.
No, I have no comments.
Okay. We, at this point, are going to move into the informational part of our agenda. And we have invited testimony today and this morning from Oregonians in Action, Thousand Friends of Oregon, the Department of Environmental Quality, Department of Land Conservation and Development, Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, and the Parks and Recreation Department. Again, part of our education process. We will try, if we can ask those that are going to testify, to at least the first time to use an acronym, to identify that acronym for us. We will not fine anybody like Representative Butler does, but we'll appreciate you starting off where we are, and that is at ground zero on the learning curve. So, I'm remiss in introducing our committee administrator, Ray Kelly. And do you have any comments, Ray?
No, Mr. Chair. Here to support. Happy to be here, and really appreciate the opportunity to go ahead and work with all you fine legislators and get that experience.
Even if you were invited, if you would, be sure and sign the sign-up sheet in the back of the hearing room. And John Chandler also was invited today. Yeah, it was just a little reminder, John. We will have Representative Close is scheduled to come in at 9 o'clock this morning. So is there anyone who would like to start off as far as just kind of beginning this period of information to this committee?
You're scared of us.
So
we just adjourn?
What if we had each one of them stand up and tell us how it's here?
Dan?
So we just adjourn?
No. Now we're having to begin to be aggressive in the committee. Mike from Parks and Recreation, you knew we were looking at you, and if you would come up, please, and begin this for us, we'd appreciate it.
Sure, I thought I smelled a conspiracy building there.
There was. Mr. Kelly kind of put the finger to you, so. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm pleased to go first this morning. My name is Mike Carrier. I'm Director of Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. And I'm pleased to go first because I'm excited about the very positive, enthusiastic start of this committee and look forward to working with you as a session on a number of issues that I hope will come before you. I know that one of our reps has already been assigned to this committee. And, Mr. Chair, I'll be making an appointment with you promptly to review that legislative concept. The other reason I'm excited is I'd like to think that Oregon's land use planning laws seek to protect the best of Oregon's inherent qualities in its landscape and achieve economic and sustainability and livability. Oregon's state parks, in my opinion, represent the finest examples of the state's cultural and natural landscape, and it's with a great deal of pride that I serve as the director of the department that administers those parks. I wanted to give you just a little brief information about the department. I've provided for you at your desk a copy of our just published biannual report, which has a lot of information that touches on the responsibilities of the department. We are a commission-led agency led by 7 commissioners who were appointed by the governor for 4-year terms and confirmed by the Senate. Those 5 of the commissioners represent Oregon's 5 congressional districts. 2 of the commissioners serve at large, one representing the area east of the Cascades and one representing the area west of the Coast Range, in other words, the ocean shores. The mission of our department is to provide outstanding natural, scenic, cultural, historic, and recreational sites for the enjoyment and education of present and future generations. And I wanted to start with that mission because I know that in times like these, it's very easy for us to lose perspective on the future of this state and some of the trends that we're seeing in terms of growing population, increasing demand for outdoor recreation, an increasing shift to a tourism and service-based economy in which people from all over the world recognize what a beautiful place this is to visit and live. And I think that mission expresses the importance of, while we deal with the problems of today, keeping one eye on the future and the needs of future generations of Oregonians and our visitors, especially as expressed through the kinds of parks, open space, and outdoor recreation opportunities we provide. Our responsibilities include the management, the development and management of 230 parks and recreation areas, which encompass over 95,000 acres throughout the state. We're responsible for stewardship of Oregon's ocean beaches, its 14 state scenic waterways, the Willamette Greenway Project, and several heritage conservation programs for Oregon, which include the State Historic Preservation Office, and I'll be excited about talking at length at some future date about what that office provides, both for Oregon as well as the Federal Historic Preservation Act responsibilities. It includes the Oregon Heritage Commission and the Oregon Pioneer Cemetery Commission. We operate on a budget for the 2003 biennium of about $135 million in expected revenues and about $130 million in expected expenditures for the current biennium. Our sources of funding include lottery, which is provided to us through Measure 66 adopted by the voters in 1998. It constitutionally directs 7.5% of lottery dollars to the department. It includes park user fees, which represents about 40% of our budget in the form of camping fees, days fees, and other miscellaneous income that we generate in our parks. It includes the registration on recreational vehicles, which is really a user fee program where people who camp pay through their vehicle registrations for the development and operation and maintenance of those campsites. It includes some federal funds and other dedicated monies such as the all-terrain vehicle permit sales that we provide. We have a full-time equivalent. I have sworn an oath against acronyms, so I won't say FTE, but we have a full-time equivalent and workforce of 501, which translates to about 740 positions. Because of the nature of our work, you can imagine we have a number of positions that are permanent, part-time, and even temporary. I wanted to turn your attention to a handout that I've provided to staff, and I hope it's been provided to you. It's a black and white handout, because I understand that one of the purposes today was just to give you a quick brief on the legislative concepts that we have forwarded to the governor and that the governor has forwarded to the legislature. And we have six legislative concepts that I'll talk about very briefly. We have been providing a number of years waiver a permit fee. We issue permits for any activity that occurs below the statutory vegetation line on the ocean shores. We're required to do that by statute. And when local governments apply for a permit that provides or enhances recreation access or citizen access to those beaches, we were waiving those fees. Our rules providing that waiver were reviewed by Leds Council, and we were advised we really didn't have authority to do that. We'd like to continue offering those waivers to local government when they provide services that we would like to see provided, and so we're seeking authority for that waiver. We have three bills that deal with Oregon's Pioneer Cemetery Program, and they include establishing a new category of misdemeanor from Class A to Class C felony, actually, from Class A misdemeanor to Class C felony, for anyone who vandalizes or intentionally damages an historic cemetery. We'd like to change the name of the Pioneer Cemetery Commission to Historic Cemetery Commission. And we'd like to require that custodians or owners or others that have custody or ownership of a Pioneer Cemetery provide notice and a opportunity for review by our commission before those cemeteries are altered in any way, such as removal of burials or markers or other historic structures. We would like authority to conduct criminal background checks on people who volunteer in our parks. One of the unique things about Oregon's park system is that we experience over 400,000 hours annually of volunteer effort in our parks. I doubt that any other state park system has the amount of volunteer effort we have. There are over 4,000 people annually who work in our parks on a volunteer basis, serving as campground hosts, working as members of friends groups who have adopted a particular park, doing a variety of services. It really speaks well to the public service and community service ethic that Oregonians have, and especially their love for parks when you see that kind of effort. Unfortunately, we get a number of people from out of state who volunteer for the first time who we know very little about. And we have found that conducting a criminal background check, especially when those volunteers are working with children and other park visitors who may be vulnerable, is important to us, and we'd like the authority to do that. A few agencies have that authority, and we do not, and we would seek that authority. And finally, we're hoping to clarify in statute our authority regarding waiving the park fees that we have in place. We have, by rule, for a number of years, been offering waivers or discounts for various reasons in our parks, which I can go into detail when we actually review that bill, and that is the first bill that's been assigned to your committee. And I simply, as a matter of assuring that there is founding authority or underlying authority to do those kinds of things, would like to clarify in statute what that authority is. So that summarizes the legislative concepts that we presented to you, and I hope you enjoy the biennial report and have an opportunity to take some time to read it, and we look forward to working with you over the session. Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Backer.
Mr. Chairman, I just have a couple of questions because I'm becoming familiar with, a little more familiar with your agency, and my questions are with respect to the allocation of lottery funds for recreational purposes. Is your agency solely responsible for that responsibility?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, Yes, when Measure 66 was adopted, 15% of the lottery was dedicated for parks and natural resources. Of that, 7.5% on the recreation, parks and recreation side comes, is appropriated to our agency.
Fine. And then my second and perhaps last question to the witness, could you basically describe the allocation of those funds for recreational purposes between state parks, county parks, and municipalities?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I would be very pleased to do that. In the current budget, the lottery on a biennial basis is providing close to $50 million a biennium to our department through the Measure 66 initiative. And in 1999, when that money was first appropriated by the legislature, it was divided in this way. $15 million was provided to the department for facility investment and improvements. In other words, our capital repairs and improvement programs. Fix the parks. And that was the big issue in 98, was the backlog of repairs that had been neglected or deferred in state parks. So that's $15 million. $4 million was appropriated by the legislature for acquisition of additional open space and parks. And the project we're currently working on as a new initiative is the Washington County Park. $5 million of the lottery was appropriated for grants to cities and counties, and we've been making those grants since 1999 for park and open space acquisition and development. In addition to, and I'll just extend on this just a little bit, because we award not just lottery money, we also have a federal land and water conservation fund, which has been in place for nearly 40 years, which provides Oregon an annual allocation of funds, 60% of which we make available to local parks and recreation departments for outdoor recreation projects. We administer, on behalf of the Department of Transportation, the Federal Recreation Trails Grant Program, which makes funds available to local units of government as well as state agencies for recreational trail projects. And we award the recreational vehicle registration fees that I talked about, 30% of those monies are allocated to the counties. In other words, we share that fee with the counties. And of that 30%, 90% is distributed to the counties based upon population, a formula that includes population and the number of campsites they operate and maintain. And 10% of those registration fees, 10% of the 30%, are awarded in competitive grants to county park departments for campground improvement projects.
Thank you. That was a very thorough answer. I appreciate that. There probably are some issues I want to pursue here, but I'll take it up separately in some meetings with their representatives. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Representative Zahner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike, on the increased penalties for intentional damage to historic cemeteries, what's the difference between the A and the C? And if we pass House Bill 2206, would we enforce those laws?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zahner, I have to apologize for not knowing the specific remedies or penalties regarding those different classes. We've been seeking, and this is an aside, we've been seeking advice from people who have...
Excuse me, Mike. I think Representative Ackerman could answer that. Could I interrupt him? The difference between A and C?
I'm going to take a stab at it. I know a Class A misdemeanor provides for maximum incarceration of 1 year in a county facility plus, I think, a $5,000 fine. I'm kind of pulling that out of my head. A felony would be, I think a Class C felony would be 5 years, and there's a fine. It's rather large. $100,000 comes into mind. I might be off a little bit on that, but that's a distinction.
Mr. Chair, I don't think you can answer, because among the advice that we've received since this concept was drafted was from Mr. Kevin Mannix, who has a passion and interest in this subject, and has advised us that taking that to a Class C felony would probably be unacceptable to the legislature, and that we ought to be seeking a different level of misdemeanor. So I suspect we'll be proposing an amendment to that language. And I will more thoroughly research what those penalties actually are.
Thank you, Mike. Have a follow-up.
I think the irony in this is that if you were convicted for probably this Class C felony alone, under guidelines, you would get a probationary sentence. But if you were sentenced for a lesser offense, the misdemeanor, the court has more discretion and could give you a year in jail. It's one of those things that we deal with. Sometimes it's better to leave it as a misdemeanor because there's a better chance of incarceration.
One follow-up on another question. On the fee waiver and discount authority, why do you want to eliminate the fees?
Mr. Chair, Representative His Honor, we, of course, need to continue to build revenue in the parks because 40% of our budget is based in parks, but there are instances in which a group of volunteers have provided a service to us and want to hold an event, or we would like to reward them in some way, and a fee waiver is a popular way of doing it. Okay. There are also occasions where the department is sponsoring some promotional event in cooperation with a local community, and the community asks for a fee waiver of some kind.
Okay, great. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We do have the definition of a Class C felony on the way to the committee, so... But it's nice to have our two attorneys, the legal portion of the committee, both down there side by side. So, Representative Greenland.
We're going to find out whether Representative Ackerman actually knows what he's talking about. Mr. Chair, I'd like to provide some evidence for your statement of the ignorance on some of our parts by asking some naive questions, if I may.
Please, proceed.
Mr. Carrier, what's a park?
What's a park?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I've spent many happy hours in your state parks, but I wonder what formally designates a park as opposed to something else.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenwood, you're talking about a legal definition, in only very general ways describes the purposes of establishing parks, but does not define park as a concept, and there are a lot of commonly accepted definitions of park, and most commonly it's just any public green space that's available for public recreation. But in Oregon, there's not a statutory definition.
Well, may I follow up, sir?
Follow up.
Well, what's a state park then? I mean, how do you know you have a state park as opposed to a piece of nice green space that people use for recreation purposes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenwick, we've addressed that in an administrative rule and how we identify and label properties. And in administrative rules, we have identified those that we officially refer to as a state park. We have others that we refer to as state natural areas. Others are referred to as state waysides. And along the Willamette Greenway, they're referred to as greenway properties. And those are established in administrative rule.
And the difference between a natural area and a park is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenwick, the difference generally is based upon the level of development, the nature of the use, and the inherent natural qualities of the area. A state natural area would be an area that was acquired and set aside because of outstanding or unique natural values, such as old-growth forest or a high-quality wetland or some other feature.
May I ask one more?
Certainly, right ahead.
Do things formally designated as state parks have mixed use, or are state parks pretty specifically only recreation? I mean, are there private homes in any of your state parks and other kinds of...
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, state parks are generally those that there is no private development, first of all, in those. There may be a privately operated concession licensed by our department to operate, but there is no other private development. And state park generally includes day use facilities such as trails and picnic areas and a campground.
And the natural resource areas, do they have other uses in them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenwood, a state natural area is the concept we use. Generally, those are the level of development is minimal. If you see any development, it usually includes a parking lot, a restroom, and some trails and interpretive signs.
Thank you, sir.
Any other questions from the
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One other follow-up. Speaking of concessions, every year we camp out at Lake Siskiyou, which is up near Mount Shasta, and it's run by individuals. It's leased, I guess, from the county. But they have great concessions, you know, even coffee in the morning. They go around with, and do we do some of those things? I've been at some of the campgrounds in Oregon. Sometimes you can't get the wood even because it's closed up or the store is closed and you can only shop at certain times. So are we doing a lot of that, and could we do more?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zahner, yes, we do some of that, and I certainly would like to do more. And past experiences in my career working in Iowa State Park System, we had a large concession program. We, in fact, are currently bidding a major concession operation for Lake Owyhee State Park over in eastern Oregon. And we've got a number of smaller concessions. Shampooey State Park, for example, a store was donated there in Butteville to us that is operated on a concession basis. And a number of others. Some of the smaller concessions that are operated by park staff or volunteers are done so because it just doesn't pencil out for a private individual to take that on, and that's an important factor because they have to carry liability insurance, have to carry employee tax costs and other things, and it's got to be a sufficient scale that it would pencil out for them to do it. But where it does, I'm certainly an advocate of creating a private business opportunity in our park if it's viable.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Representative Roosevelt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike, I know that the funding and maintenance of the Pioneer Cemeteries has been a problem in the past. Has that been resolved, or are they fairly secure now, or is that still an open question?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, thank you for that question, because the way the Pioneer Cemetery Commission is funded now is simply through the programming of dollars, which is a part of our base budget and is secure, for a part-time staff person that serves as an administrator to the commission. One of the policy option packages that is included in our budget request before the legislature is to establish a small program of $85,000 in grants for biennium to provide for signage, for protection and other things to enhance or otherwise protect Pioneer Cemetery Commissions. And that may seem like a small amount of money, but it will go a long ways with these small cemeteries.
So follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So the only general fund money now is this part-time staff person?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, it is not general fund money. Our agency, and I'm really glad you asked that question, because our agency is one that operates with no general fund dollars. And while some thought that was not a wise thing for the legislature to do in 99, I think it was a very wise thing to do, and it certainly has been a benefit to us these days. So we fund the Pioneer Cemetery Commission with Measure $66.
Oh, I see. Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much for coming this morning, and we'll look forward to seeing you again when we deal with some of the bills.
Thank you.
Thank you. We are at the moment trying to get the representative close. So whoever I ask to come up next, we might have to interrupt you when the representative arrives. And I see, John, you're just smiling way too much this morning, so would you come up and be interrupted at some time here? Thank you. Good morning.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. It's nice to know I'm going to be interrupted instead of just having it happen, although that's not a bad strategy. I commend you for it. I'm here this morning just to give you a little bit of background from the developer's standpoint on the land use and environment system. I represent a number of clients who come from that perspective, the Oregon Building Industry Association, the home builders, involved in residential and light commercial. I also have clients, the Urban Developers Coalition, that is a group of industrial and commercial developers from the Portland area predominantly, and also the International Council of Shopping Centers, who, as the name implies, is interested in retail development issues. We'll be bringing bills forward to you. I suspect they'll end up in this committee, and at that time I'll walk through all the particulars. But I think this morning, if I can, I'd just like to give you a little bit of an overview of the system from our standpoint. Some of you haven't, as you observed earlier, haven't had the chance to really delve into this, and you're in for a treat. Oregon land use is a many tentacled piece of policy in this state, as I'm sure you're aware, even if you don't know the particulars. It overlays almost every other aspect of state government, local government. It's part of our vision of who we are as a state. We are the first state in the country really to adopt a statewide land use planning system. We've received a great many slings and arrows and applauds for that from elsewhere in the country. We've become a model for places around the world. There's a planning migration that goes through Oregon on a regular basis. My clientele supports the system, and I think it's very important to state that at the outset. We see ourselves oftentimes as the loyal opposition, but the operative word there is loyal. We believe in land use planning. We think it's been good for business. We think it's been good for our communities. We think it's been good for the state. And so our approach and our legislative packages over the years and ours this session will come from that perspective. I think what you'll find when you hear the various interest groups and you start hearing the specific bills dealing with the arcana of the system, that there's broad agreement in principle on the goals and the background of Oregon land use planning. There is strident and vigorous and loud disagreement on the particulars. And in some ways, that may disclose a very healthy system. In this case, I think it discloses some fundamental issues that need to be talked about. And I think what you'll see, and this is obviously overbroad, and you'll have other speakers who can fill in the gaps better than I'm going to, is if you can think of it perhaps conceptually as the system, the Oregon land use system, when it started out in 1973 when Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the Oregon Senate Bill 100 under his arm, it was primarily a farm and forest preservation system. It was a protection scheme that was unprecedented in the country where we were going to treat production agriculture and production forestry as industries, and we were going to try to give them the same deference we gave any other type of industrial use, and going to try to prohibit or at least curtail competing uses, make sure they had a sufficient base for their operations. And it made perfect sense because that was our economy then. The state of Oregon was in the early 70s a predominantly agricultural and timber state. Since then, we passed the law then, all the cities and counties were required to do comprehensive planning, every city in the state had to go off and do urban growth boundaries and all the other paraphernalia that go along with a statewide system, and there were a few hiccups at the ballot box along the way. Most of the comprehensive planning was done and adopted and often approved by the state by the early 80s, and about the same time, and I wish it was a causal relationship because it'd make my rhetorical job much simpler, but it wasn't, it was simply coincidental, at about the same time the state's economy went in the tank. So for a good chunk of the Oregon land use system's working life, it has had very little growth to manage. And growth management is simple when there isn't any. For a good part of the 80s, most of the biggest task facing us was making sure we had a few halls to get people where the jobs were. What we're dealing with now, I believe, a lot of the grinding noises you hear come from two things. One is the focus on the rural that took place during the time that our economy was slumping and we were focusing on the farm and forest preservation. If you look through, and I'm sure you'll have many, many bills on this, because unless this session is like the rest of them have been, you'll get a whole bunch of bills dealing with what uses can be allowed in the farm zone or forest zone. We passed a bill a few sessions ago, for example, saying that you could grow bugs in a farm zone. I grew up farming, and I didn't think bugs were a problem one way or the other. A bill prohibiting bugs would have been impressive, but a bill allowed them, and I didn't think it was all that necessary. But we have gotten very restrictive on the rural side. So a lot of the bills you're going to hear, and a lot of the comments you've probably heard from constituents, involve those rural restrictions and the burden or benefit that people feel they may provide. On the urban side, because for so much of the history of the program, there wasn't a lot of economic activity going on, a lot of growth happening, the urban side didn't get a lot of attention. And so now we're getting a new set of grinding noises coming from the urban pieces, which is where my clients get into the act for the most part, because it simply didn't get as much attention in the planning system. And in many ways, I believe that right now, with our urban growth piece of the land use planning program, we're simply asking our planning processes to do tricks they weren't trained to do. Doing urban development in a 2003 economy is different than doing land use planning and development in a 1973 economy. Things have changed. Our state economy has changed. The state's industrial base has changed. Our state expectations of its communities have changed. Our system hasn't modified as fast or as well as it could have, I believe, to address that. That's the situation we're in. I believe. We have now, I think, a need to focus more on urban issues, on urban development issues, on economic development issues, on how to get the process to function, the 19 statewide planning goals to focus on not only protection of saying what we cannot do, but saying what we want. and to get more to a point where the system is worried and focused on allowing things to happen rather than prohibiting them from happening. That's easier said than done. And it's an issue about which reasonable minds can and will differ, and many of them can and will differ right here at this table as the next few months go by.
I apologize for that.
That's not a problem. our bills this session, I'll be just walk through kind of the broad principles. We and previous sessions as well have dealt with kind of two broad issues. One is the issue of balance in the program. We, as I said, we have 19 statewide planning goals. I'm sure somebody will walk you through what they all do and what they relate to. There's supposedly a balance struck between the various pieces of the program. From our perspective, jobs, housing have not been given as much weight in that balance as some other factors such as agricultural protection or environmental protection and some other things. We'll not be saying in front of you in any legislative action that we ought to get a priority, that we think we ought to get an even split. We don't believe that has occurred. The deal, if you will, that originally struck when urban growth boundaries were drawn and the farm and forest preservation part of the system kicked in was that it was supposed to be easy to develop inside of cities, and by so doing that would be making it easier to protect the rural areas, and it was supposed to be difficult to develop in the rural areas. As it has unfolded, it has become even more difficult to develop in rural areas and much more difficult inside. And that doesn't work. If you're going to prohibit one place, assuming an economy is growing, you have to allow it someplace else. In many of our cities, we didn't do a very good job of communicating with ourselves collectively about what our vision was for our town, what kind of housing we wanted, what kind of jobs we wanted, where we wanted them to be, how we wanted them to connect, all of those things that create ruckuses at city council chambers. We didn't talk about that as much as we should have. And so now we have a situation where that which the planning says is allowed doesn't actually happen. And from our standpoint, the planning, the zoning should dictate development. The things once discussed and agreed upon at the level of planning should be allowed to happen. And because, frankly, it sounds rhetorical, my clients build the plans. And that if the project can't be financed, built, and sold, it doesn't really matter what the planning calls for because it won't happen. And that's where we believe we have a stake as a partnership in this process. The other issue that we can deal with is procedural. The system has become very cumbersome. It has become a lawyer's game. I'm a recovering attorney myself, but I understand lawyers' games. They're kind of fun, but not necessarily productive. And they're not usually fun for anybody but the lawyers, but that's a whole other conversation. Moving an urban growth boundary, for example, is a very, very difficult process. It should be a difficult process. We probably don't need to attach as many varies on the front end as we have. Getting a permit, from a land development permit, a building permit, any sort of governmental activity has become very cumbersome. Governor Kulongoski during the campaign had a one-liner he used, which I personally like quite a bit, that it shouldn't take longer to get the permit than it does to build the building. That's a nice bumper sticker, but it's also an accurate statement, I believe, of what part of the disconnect in our system is. And finally, we haven't thought as much as we probably should have. We didn't need to. Times were good. It wasn't raining. We didn't fix the roof. Now the times have gotten a little harder. We're starting to look at all aspects of state government and local government, how they affect jobs and the economy. I think we're going to be spending some time this session looking at the connection of the land use system, the environmental regulatory system, and job creation. Not again. And Rosenbaum, I particularly appreciate what you said at the outset, and I'd like to underscore from my standpoint, it isn't that we're going to say jobs are number one, everything else takes second place. It's that we have that balance. I think we can do it. I think we're smart enough to do it. It's a question of how being smart enough to figure out how to negotiate between the various competing interests and achieve that balance. The key issues for my clientele, Mr. Chairman, this session are going to be a follow-up to a bill from last session. House Bill 4557, some of you probably remember, set up a working group with the State Department of Land Conservation and Development and the Economic Development Department to go off and look at commercial industrial land supplies. They've issued a report which will be coming to the legislative body. It's a very good piece of work, and there's a number of very substantive recommendations contained in that report that we'll be bringing forward in some fashion for your consideration involving how to get sites ready to develop in an expeditious fashion. One of the things, just by way of giving you the background that we found in this work group, was that we've done a pretty fair job of long-range planning. We have pretty good for the most part around the state, 20-year supplies of industrial and commercial land, but we don't have 20-day supplies in a lot of places. And we don't have a short-term ability to deliver a site for someone wanting to site a factory or a job creating operation. We're going to have a bill asking for a long-term look at the land use system. Some of you know that over the last bunch of years it's been fiddled with and tweaked and amended, and I've done a fair chunk of that myself. We haven't really had a fundamental conversation for, for 30 years now about how the land use system works and what we expect it to do and how it ought to function, and I think it's time to do that. I don't think a legislative process, with all due respect, is the way to do that. It's not a binary issue. It's not a red or green button issue. It's a thoughtful issue, and we're going to be bringing the bill forward, asking the governor to establish a, for want of a different color, blue ribbon committee to look at the land use system. And a report back in 2005 legislative session with suggested changes and thoughts on it, and hopefully go out and engage our public again in the trade-offs that are inherent, the balance that's inherent in the system I think we've lost track of. And finally, we'll be talking, I think, this New York State model on regulatory reform. If you haven't heard of it, I would commend it to you. During the first Pataki administration, New York State had seen a great many jobs and headquarters and whatnot leave New York for other jurisdictions, and they went about a very stringent and serious effort at regulatory reform in a way that apparently, if I can believe the state of New York's website, kept enough people happy on all sides of the issue to have it function. And they did such things as a moratorium on new rules where they figured out what they wanted, asking agencies to eliminate duplicative and redundant rules and try to streamline processes without doing away with the objective, keeping the goals, fixing the system. I think that's worth looking at here. We'll be bringing bills forward to talk about that. And Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for your time. Thank you for the opportunity to address you this morning. We'll be back on a number of occasions, I'm sure, but I'll be glad to answer any questions the committee may have.
Representative, question. Recovering attorneys, can you explain that? Do you have weekly meetings? And I haven't seen one, I don't think.
It's a 12-step program. I'm on about the second step, Representative Honor.
I think at this point, to accommodate Representative Close's schedule, and I'm not quite sure what her schedule is. We're checking on that at the moment, but we wanted to try and get her in here. So, John, are you going to be around a little bit more this morning?
I am.
If we could maybe ask you to come back.
Sure.
And take some questions, but we'll have to wait for just a moment here to see. She's not going to be available?
Okay.
Let's proceed with questions then. But John, any other questions? Thank you, John. Representative Green,
Chair. I'm intrigued, and I've heard a lot of comment in my area on the 20-day, and it's probably not the 20-day, but it's certainly the 6 months or two-year or three-year supply of industrial land. What sort of proposals do you think will come forward to deal with the question of industrial short-term supply of industrial lands?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenick, that's a very good question. I'll give you what I think may happen. I'll tell you what the 3557 committee talked about. The committee very specifically didn't say go and do these three things and your problem's fixed. We're having actually kind of schedule a meeting for a week or so from now, and a bunch of us were involved in that process to try to see if we can't come up with a consensus package to bring forward. So I don't want to get ahead of that. There's several parts to that issue, but one is a lot of places the land simply isn't zoned right. The zoning doesn't allow for the uses that the community thinks they want. That's a fairly, on paper, an easy fix for the community to go out and make sure the zoning is there. There may be a very good opportunity for the state to participate, particularly the smaller jurisdictions, the EDD or DLCD, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, Economic Development Department or Department of Land Conservation Development. The work that local governments and providing technical assistance.
You have to say it's slower anyway, so we can.
It's like having an auction. That's one issue. The other one of the key issues is infrastructure, that the land simply doesn't have water, sewer, streets, etc. That partly is a planning process problem that we can address through a planning system. In more cases than not, it's a money problem. And money problems, as you all are aware, are a little more difficult than conceptual planning problems. And I don't know the answer to that one. If it's a reorientation of what existing state money may be left for economic development, if it's something else, buying lottery tickets out of state, I don't know. That's a big piece. If there's an environmental constraint, I think probably the biggest thing that the state could do is to work, and I know that the Economic Development Department has done some preliminary work on designating sites around the state, and somebody from their shop ought to be, can fill in the blanks if I'll get it wrong, I'm sure. But basically, fill it, to go out and look at a community, pick sites around the state, X number of sites, that are real close to being shovel ready, that need something, need a road, need a sewer line, need something to happen, need a wetland delineation or what have you. And then focus the state, rather than having a more diverse approach at EDD, Economic Development, focus on those sites to make sure that the money then puts in the trunk line, puts in the infrastructure, runs the fiber optic, something of that sort. Those are some of the ideas, I think, little Tom.
If I may follow up. Oh. And, of course, you don't want to take a long time to get a solution to the fact that we don't have short-term supply. To what extent is the problem on industrial sites that some of your other clients have argued for commercial uses in what might otherwise be industrial sites, and the need to keep those sites so identified as industrial sites in large enough lot sizes so that we actually can site a factory on them?
Mr. Chairman, that is a real problem, the protection of industrial sites somehow. And then land banking may be one idea, helping a landowner with holding costs, or it's easy, and I'm not suggesting that this is where your question is going, but I've heard other conversations where the various parts of the real estate industry got played off against each other. Mm-hmm. The reality is, in a lot of communities, there was poaching, pure and simple, that a site was industrial, now it's commercial, probably shouldn't have been now that we look at it. But in a lot of communities, the industrial land was what was left after everything else got zoned. And there wasn't necessarily a whole lot of thought that went in. Once you got beyond the obvious industrial zoned land, the stuff right by the rail line, right by the water, that kind of thing, the mill sites, usually when cities did zoning, you knew where the houses were, where you wanted more houses, you knew where the apartments were, and didn't want any apartments in the first place, but you put them over here, and then you knew where the shopping was, and then whatever was left, you cut a tank and call it industrial. And so a lot of the erosion of industrial land to commercial or residential or mixed uses isn't a bad thing. It's simply that the land shouldn't have been zoned industrial in the first place. One of the things we've been kicking around internally, and I haven't really finished thinking this one through, in environmental protection, for example, under statewide planning goal 5, which deals with environmental issues, a jurisdiction is free to go through their process locally and identify whatever natural, scenic, water, et cetera, resources they choose. But it's a zero sum if they take land out of the urban growth boundary, for example, you know, basically within the urban growth boundary, protected as a wetland or as a scenic area or what have you. They have to make allowance for that land someplace else in development. In other words, you take it, it's not necessarily acre for acre, but at least conceptually, for working purposes, let's say you take out a 10-acre wetland, you then would look for a 10-acre, the equivalent 10-acre of development land someplace else that wasn't environmentally constrained, if that makes sense. And maybe something like that for industrial zones would be appropriate, that if an industrial zone is eroded by other uses, even if they make sense, we then find other industrially zoned land to make up for that, so you always have a supply. That's more of a long-term solution. It would keep us, that something like that perhaps would keep us from getting into this problem again in a few years.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, John. Oh, Representative.
Yeah, I'm concerned because I know that the son of Measure 7 is coming back to this committee. I'm wondering if there is a connection between the implementation of Measure 7 and the thwarting of a development. In other words, under Measure 7, if a city or a county granted environmental concessions or zoning concessions to a major plant which lowered the property values of other people, and they have claims against the city or county for siting this plant, do you view that as the thwarting industrial development, or have we reached that point yet?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to go get Representative Close for you, if you'd like.
No, stay right there.
How a property compensation measure, such as Measure 7 or some other one of its progeny, I think you'll be lucky, frankly, if you just get the son of 7. I think you may get second and third cousins of 7 wandering through here. I don't know. And certainly one of the concerns that I would have about any sort of mechanism like that is to make sure that it doesn't have unintended consequences. And that would certainly, in my mind anyhow, be an unintended consequence that you somehow curtail development that was otherwise warranted and wanted because of the fear of diminution of property values in surrounding areas. If I can, I'd like to just, I'm glad you raised the issue of Measure 7. That wasn't, none of my clients were involved in the passage of it. We obviously understood why it passed, and I would suggest to you, and I've not seen any of the legislation that's coming forward, and I'm not likely going to be involved with it. Measure 7 didn't pass because voters got lazy, smart on a bunch of them, and then dumb on one. It passed because there's a problem out there. It may be a perceptual problem, it may be actual, but it is a, as you know, perceptions are reality when it comes to political issues. And I would encourage you to keep that in mind as you're considering not just the various family lineages of Measure 7, but other bills that come in front of you, that to the extent that this committee and this legislature can help make the system function better, smoother, faster, fairer, that addresses, I think, the core issues behind ballot measure 7, which wasn't necessarily motivated so much by the compensation issue as it was, I believe, personally anyhow, frustration at the process. And that was a vehicle to express that frustration, partly, frankly, because we hadn't, some of the folks involved in this issue had not felt satisfaction elsewhere.
Thank you, John. It's your opportunity to get out.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Ross Day. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ross Day. I'm the Director of Legal Affairs for Oregonians in Action. Mailing address is 8255 Southwest Hunziker in Tigard, Oregon. I want to thank you for this opportunity to address the committee today. I'm addressing you today as Director of Legal Affairs of Oregonians in Action. Only been on the job, if you will, for about 2.5 weeks, so I'm still getting my feet wet. Prior to my life with Oregonians in Action, I was an attorney in Portland with a developing land use practice, and most of my experience with Oregon's land use system to date is more anecdotal than it is dealing with the system as a whole. So to that extent, I want to echo the sentiments of Mr. Chandler. And I think that as a whole, the system is a good thing. I think there are just some things that need to be tweaked. I also come to you with a little bit of experience from the other side. I currently sit as a member of the State Capital Planning Commission. I was appointed by Governor Kithopper 2 years ago. And I'm also a member of the City of Kaiser Planning Commission as well. So I get an opportunity to experience the land use system from both sides, if you will. And I come to you with experience and the scars to prove it. One other thing, too, and this is a play for pity. I have my cell phone on. My wife is 8 months and three and a half weeks pregnant. If it goes off, I might be getting out of here quick. So, yes, I'm hoping for pity from the committee. I do represent Oregonians in Action. We'll frankly be commonly referred to as OIA. We are the largest private property rights group organization in the country. And we primarily concern ourselves with issues relating to takings and compensation and other associated property rights. Contrary to popular belief, Oregonians in Action also supports Oregon's system of land use planning. We don't want to dismantle the system. We certainly think that it plays an important role in our society, and that it's actually a good thing. However, we do recognize that there are some tweaks that need to be made to the system. In essence, what we work to do is we try to restore basically balance to the system that Mr. Chandler alluded to before. That, you know, we've kind of gotten off away from balancing, you know, the considerations of jobs and the economy. We've kind of let that go by the wayside, and that's what our primary efforts are. Mr. Chandler did a pretty good job of explaining basically what our system of land use laws in the state are. Essentially, what we do at a local level is we classify dirt, basically. You can use this area for to build homes. You can use this area to build commercial uses, industrial uses, and whatnot. As Mr. Chandler stated earlier, the real fight to get into is, well, what uses constitute a commercial use or an industrial use? And over the years, that has led to some pretty historic battles and has led to delays and permitting processes and whatnot. I can give you an anecdotal example up in the city of Kaiser. We recently rezoned an area of land just south of the Volcano Stadium. It was zoned for millions of years, as I like to say, industrial, and always been industrial land. But it wasn't possible to put an industrial use on that piece of property. Landowners there wanted to leave, but couldn't leave because they couldn't sell their property at a halfway decent market rate value. And so they're pretty much landlocked. The city of Kaiser instituted a legislative amendment to its zoning code and its comprehensive plan. We rezoned the property because somebody came in, a developer came in and said, well, we can't do anything with this land as industrial use. We can change it to commercial, which is what it was intended to be used for about 25 years ago when we first started the process in Kaiser. And as a result, these people would be able to sell their homes as they wanted to, get a reasonable return on their land. Development will bring in economic development to the city of Kaiser, both family wage jobs and starting wage jobs as well to the area. That was 2 years ago that we started that process. If you drive north to Woodburn or Portland or points in between, you'll notice that it's still not developed because the various regulatory agencies involve City of Salem, the Farm and Land Conservation Development, caught myself there, Mr. Chair, have slowed the process down. Economic development that could have been realized in the City of Kaiser as quickly as a year ago is still going on, and now the developer is making noises that he may very well just pull out of the project altogether. I don't think that's what our system of land use laws was intended to do, to stymie development. Those are basically our concerns. In terms of what our legislative agenda is, OIA believes that there are instances, Oregon Needs an Action, I already explained to the committee what OIA was. There are certain instances where our zoning laws have been misapplied or misused to the extent that certain people are unable to either use their property, sell their property, or somewhere in between. We have, and by miszoning unproductive ag land, for instance, individuals aren't able to build dwellings, or they may not be able to develop their property in other manners that might be beneficial not only to them but also to the community. If they're able to develop that, develop their property in such a way, simply build a home, that not only provides jobs and whatnot for the local community, but it also increases property tax revenues for the local governments as well. So our agenda this session, in a nutshell, is basically to address a lot of these problems. We don't have anything major, at least at this point, that, at least by our standards, we're not suggesting dismantling the land use system as a whole, but maybe providing tweaks to the system, if you will, to allow landowners, particularly landowners in rural communities, the opportunity to develop, and realize and harvest the full economic benefit of their property by encouraging economic development, hopefully increasing property tax bases for local communities. That is it in a nutshell. I don't want to echo everything that Mr. Chandler said. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Day. Any questions of Mr. Day?
Some of the constituents I deal with, I guess it's the overlap. They're dealing with the city trying to develop some of the property, and they're working through that process, and then the state rule or another law is involved, and they really don't know where to go, and it just takes forever. And is there some way we can get kind of all of those together so the guy could go into one thing, you know, one office, and that piece of property would be, you know, that office could handle his property even if there's two or three other agencies involved, different layers. God, it takes forever. And pretty soon they just throw up their hands, you know. Is there any way we can help these people to do that? And is that overlap as big a problem as I think it is?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chair, I certainly think there is something that could be done. Governor Kulongoski, in his remarks to the legislature on Monday, mentioned streamlining the permit process, and I think that what you're speaking about is the tack that I think that Governor Kulongoski was taking. Certainly, one of the problems that we see is a duplication of efforts at the state level and at the local level as well. And if you live in the Portland area, a triplication of efforts, if you will, where you've got to deal with not only the Department of Land Conservation and Development, but also Metro and either the county or the city as well. And that can be at times unduly burdensome. I'll give you another anecdotal example. I represented a gentleman, most of my clients were marinas, and he out on Savi Island, and he is very environmentally conscious and wanted to do whatever he could for the environment. He noticed one day that his sewage facility was leaking sewage into the river, which is not a good thing by anybody's standards, I would believe, unless you're the city of Portland. In that case, it might be okay. But he said, he called up the Department of Environmental Quality and said, I'm leaking sewage into the Multnomah Channel. What do I do? And they thought he was kidding because they'd never had anybody call up and say, hey, guess what? I'm polluting, you know. So they came up, and they were very excited because he said, you know, I want to invest in the most environmentally sound sewage facility that they have on the market, $275,000 sewage facility that recycles everything, I think. Department of Environmental Quality was excited, worked with him, got things going. He had got all the equipment on the property. The only thing he needed to do was to get his facility permit. In order to get a facility permit with the Department of Environmental Quality, and this is the case with most of these departments, is you have to get a local government to sign off. Well, he's in unincorporated Multnomah County, so he had to go to Multnomah County. One of the things he had done on his property, in addition to this sewage facility, was he placed a recycling structure, if you will, on his property so that his tenants could come and place their recyclables within the structure. One of the problems he had was out on the channel with the rain and the wind, the recyclables were blowing into the channel, so he put a roof over it. Well, the county wouldn't sign off on his facility permit until he took the roof off of his structure. But if he takes the roof off of his structure, everything blows into the river, which defeats the purpose, his original purpose of getting the environmentally sensitive sewage facility. The point here is what Vice Chair Chuck Zarin was saying earlier is you're caught in a quagmire there. There's just you've got to jump through so many hoops that, you know, people who are trying to do good in the first place just kind of throw up their hands and they say, well, I'm moving to Washington or Idaho or wherever else. And I don't think that's what our system was originally intended to do.
Representative Zahn, if you would ask questions that take less of a lengthy response.
Well, I'm short. I think you blame it on him.
Yeah. I am an attorney, and when you give me an open mic, I will take advantage.
Are you a recovering attorney, or are you
still
away from that?
No, I'm still practicing.
Any other questions of Mr. Day? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Randy Tucker.
You bring the phone book. The phone
got the paperwork. You don't have to read it all. At least not right now.
Good morning, Randy.
Good morning.
Those were your notes.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Randy Tucker. I'm not a recovering attorney. I, in fact, I took preventive action instead and got into law school and decided not to go. I don't really have a title. I'm with 1,000 Friends of Oregon. My cards say Legislative Affairs and Media Relations, and only after they were printed did I realize that Affairs and Relations wasn't necessarily the way to just describe what I do, but there you have it. And before I launch into my testimony, I'd like to just say to Ross, if you're still back there, welcome to the fray, and my comment is that having a child is not a cause for pity, it's a cause for joy, but having a child during the session might be a cause for pity. So anyway, congratulations. We had a child just after the end of last session. That worked out very well. 1,000 Friends of Oregon, I think you're at least somewhat familiar with us, but let me tell you a little bit about us as an organization. We're a nonprofit corporation that was founded in 1975 by Governor Tom McCall and Henry Richmond, and we work to protect and conserve Oregon's productive farm and forest and rangelands, to promote compact and livable cities that have a range of housing options for people of all incomes and in every community, to increase transportation choices, to ensure an adequate variety and availability of parks and green spaces in every community, very importantly, to defend the opportunities for citizens to participate in the land use planning process. As you may or may not know, goal one of the statewide planning goals is citizen participation, and we take that very seriously. We have a new director this session. I don't know if any of you knew our ex-director, our former director, Robert Liberty, but we are now led by Bob Stacey, who has just returned to Oregon after a stint in Washington, D.C. He's got a long experience in the private and public and nonprofit sectors working on land use and transportation planning. He's very knowledgeable. I'll bring him down one of these days to talk with all of you. And our staff includes specialists in farm and forest land protection and urban development and urban design, in affordable housing, an area that we've always been concerned with, but are going to be spending more time focusing on from now on, now that we have a staff who are devoted to it, and transportation. We also have members in every legislative district in the state. The percentage of our members that live east of the Cascades is about the same as the percentage of Oregonians that live east of the Cascades. We have 4 regional offices in Salem, Eugene, Grants Pass, and Bend. Is Grants Pass in your district, Representative Richardson? No, close. Anyway. We also have 13 local affiliate groups around the state. These are local citizens that have started their own organizations that we collaborate with. Our members and staff and board include Republicans and Democrats and Independents, and our board of directors is quite varied. We have members from Scappoose and Hermiston and Bandon and Dundee and the Dalles, as well as Portland, Salem, Medford, Eugene. We have the former director of the Oregon Forest Industries Council on our board, as well as the urban naturalist for the Audubon Society of Portland. So we encompass a lot of different interests on our board. And we work with an advisory committee of farmers to develop our farmland protection policies, and we're also developing putting together an urban development advisory committee to help us work on our policies for what happens inside urban growth boundaries. There have been a number of recent sort of third-party reports and studies that have come out that I've summarized very briefly in the written materials I've provided for you that affirm the benefits and some of the successes of Oregon's land use planning program. And by the way, just a note that you hear different things about has the system evolved with the times, has it changed over time as things have changed in Oregon, and we can certainly argue as to whether it's changed enough or too much or whatever. But we did this a few years ago. We compiled all the changes to the land use program since it was first developed. We did this before the 99 session. So here's Senate Bill 100, the white sheets. Pink sheets are changes to the program in the 70s. The green ones are changes to the program in the 80s. And the yellow ones are changes to the land use program in the 90s through 97. So clearly, there's been a lot of work on this program. It hasn't been cast in stone since 1973. And obviously, That's to be expected. It's a good thing that we continue to look at it. But just the idea that it's been frozen in time for 30 years is not exactly correct. And no one today said that, but we do hear that on occasion. I just want to call your attention to a few of these things that have come out. I'm going to hold this one up. I don't have copies for everybody. Forest, Farms, and People, a study that came out, a collaboration between the USDA, DLCD, ODO, never mind, United States Department of Agriculture, the Department of Land Conservation and Development, the Oregon Department of Forestry, and the Oregon Department of Agriculture put this together. And it really has a lot of good evidence that Oregon's land use planning program has been successful in reducing the conversion of our productive resource lands to non-resource uses. It also has some evidence that there's still a lot of development going on in the farm zones. And in fact, during the time period this looks at, 1973 to 2000, there's been approximately a doubling of structures within our farm and forest and resource zones, according to this report. A report that I've stuck a single page in that pile of paper I gave you, that should show up to you as a little map with a lot of dots on it. Came out earlier this year, last year, from Northwest Environment Watch, comparing development outside urban growth boundaries across the Columbia River between Vancouver and the Portland area. And you can see that on the Portland side of the river, there's been a significantly less population growth in the farm and forest zones than on the Washington side, and that's primarily due to the land use planning program. In fact, Clark County lost from the about 1980 to 1990, Clark County lost significantly more land of its farmland to development than Washington County. There's a great comparison that shows that the production of Clark County farms declined 10%, while the farm production in Washington County increased 36% at the same time, primarily due to the land use planning program that protects that land from development. There is a very good study that came out from the Brookings Institution earlier this year that examined the link between growth management and housing affordability, and I've included an excerpt in the written materials, but essentially what it said was that urban growth boundaries, by limiting land supply, is not necessarily a link to the price of housing from the fact of urban growth boundaries, because growth management programs are a lot more than urban growth boundaries, and they in fact provide more housing within the urbanized area if they're well designed, and in fact the Oregon program is designed that way. John Chandler made some comments that we largely agree with, having to do with industrial lands. Let's talk just for a second about land use planning and the economy. During the last major recession, 20 years ago, a lot of people blamed Oregon's relatively new at that time land use laws for the poor economy, and there were initiatives filed to repeal the entire land use planning program at that time. Governor Attia created a task force chaired by Stafford Hansel, pig farmer, former legislator at that time, to examine the impact of the land use laws on economic development. And that task force went all around the state, and they could not identify a single instance where the land use laws actually caused a community anywhere in the state to miss out on an economic opportunity. The follow-up to that process was that the task force recommended adding economic development provisions to the land use statutes, and Thousand Friends helped to pass and implement those provisions. Among them were making statewide planning goal 9, the economic development goal, mandatory for local governments rather than merely advisory. So fast forward now to 2001, and John described the process that resulted from the bill you passed, House Bill 3557. It created the Advisory Committee for Commercial and Industrial Lands. Our staff attorney, Mary Kyle McCurdy, who will appear before you probably several times this session, was a member of this committee. And as John said, the final report is forthcoming any minute now. The report says, well, John said this, as well, the land use planning laws provide right now for both long-term and short-term supplies of land, long-term availability, short-term readiness. However, the implementation of those laws has not been up to snuff. And so we are very interested in working with you, with the governor and state agencies and other parties to ensure that Goal 9, which does require short-term shovel-ready, as the phrase is most recently, lands to be available for industrial development to actually be implemented, and we'll be working with you to make sure that happens. Farmland protection, we'll be talking a lot about it this session, I'm sure. Agriculture, even though it has now been surpassed as our resource economy has been changed to an economy that, where there's a lot of high tech, obviously. But agriculture is still the number two export industry in this state, and in fact, over the last year, agricultural exports have increased while high tech exports have dropped about 30%. So it's still a very, very important industry in this state. We've worked for our entire history to prevent development that's unrelated to agriculture from occurring in the farm zones. And I believe you'll hear from the Farm Bureau, Mr. Chair. I assume you're going to be hearing from the Farm Bureau pretty soon. But we agree with the statements that they've made that the statewide land use planning has been the single most effective tool in preventing Oregon's farmland from being adversely impacted by dwellings not related to agricultural uses and by other non-farm uses in the farm zones. Just a couple of things to say. There are about 1,000 new houses built every year in Oregon's farm zones. So the idea that our farmland is shut down for development is actually not true. There are more and more non-farm uses added to the list of uses allowed in our farm zones every session. And when you add that to the number of houses that get built, the accumulated impact is that it makes it more difficult to carry on with productive agriculture in our farm zones. So eventually you reach a tipping point where areas of the state become, they can't really support productive agriculture. So we want to work with you and look forward to working with you to continue to protect Oregon's agricultural land for future generations. As far as our legislative agenda, I've handed you a sheet that includes several items. A couple of things that might come before you here, I would imagine, are in the purview of your committee. Smaller reforms that we would be asking you to consider. One is to put a reasonable cap on the level of appeals fees that are charged by local governments. The land use program is enforced only, or almost entirely, through appeals of land use decisions. There is no land use police in the state that can enforce our laws. And citizens do a lot of that work as part of the participatory nature of the program. Some local governments, not all by any means, have instituted exorbitant appeals fees of upwards of $3,000 that are really beyond the range of an average citizen who might want to participate in the process. And we'd like you to, we hope you'll take a look at that. We also have a minor tweak we'd like you to consider to the forest template dwelling rules. These are houses that are allowed in forests in areas that are already impacted by surrounding development. There's a loophole that allows people, instead of being able to build a house, which is what the legislature intended, to shuffle the ownership of various underlying parcels in order to get to build a whole bunch of houses. That wasn't the intent of the legislation. Yeah, and to our understanding, we'd like to take a look at that. We'll also be working with the realtors on a piece of legislation to slightly modify the land use notice requirements so that they're clearer, so that they are more accurate, as well as so that they're sent out at the right time. We're collaborating on making sure that we have a consensus bill to present to you if it comes to you on that topic. So I'll stop there. I think I've probably talked long enough. I guess I should close by saying that I'd like to harken back to the speaker's speech the other day. She she said that there are going to be no prizes for predicting rain, but there will be prizes for building arcs. And, you know, the climate, to carry the metaphor forward, the climate for land use planning hasn't always been balmy in the legislature over the last couple of sessions, and we're hoping that there will be a warmer climate for discussion of these issues, and that we will be arc builders as well, rather than you know, just sitting around and complaining about the weather. So thanks very much for the opportunity. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Tucker?
I have a question for you. Mr. Tucker, if we were to help conserve the rights of citizens to make appeals by lowering or having a cap on the amount of charges that could be made for appeals fees, would it also be appropriate to limit the availability of appeals to those citizens who are adversely affected?
Well, the program is intended to be an open process, and that's why, Mr. Chair, and Vice Chair Richardson, I think the intention of the land use program is to be open, and the legislature has previously passed legislation allowing anyone that participates in the anyone that expresses views on the record to participate in the process. We believe that that continues to be appropriate, and you know, who's affected is a matter, I would think, of some argument. You know, are you affected by changes in your community that change, that, you know, affect your quality of life, or are you only affected if you have a financial interest? We would certainly argue for a more expansive definition of who's affected. The fact is that there are not a lot of land use appeals that actually occur in this state. There are, you know, upwards of 20,000 land use decisions a year, and only about 200, about 1% of those are appealed. And so many of those appeals are, many of the projects are upheld when those appeals occur. So we don't believe that land use appeals themselves are really a problem. In fact, it's failure to enforce the land use laws is the problem that appeals are designed to address. And so we'll certainly be open to any discussion about who, you know, about how the process works. But we would like to have it be an open process that allow people to participate.
Any other questions?
Sir.
Representative Bitchley.
I see, Mr. Chair, Mr. Tucker, one of your legislative issues is around system development charges. It's a very big issue in my district where homes are built very rapidly without any accounting for the schools and the parks and a variety of other things. And there is a statute that prevents system development charges now for education, is that right? Well, a lot
sure.
of it for other things. Can you expand a little bit on what sorts of legislation we'll expect to see from you and your colleagues on the system development charges?
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick. We actually are not introducing legislation ourselves, but last session a coalition of a bunch of organizations and individuals formed to advocate for expanding the system development charges legislation. Just a step back. System development charges are only allowed right now for roads, parks, water supply, sewage treatment, and stormwater treatment. And there are several other growth-related infrastructure needs that become needed when development occurs, for which you cannot recover the costs or even a portion of those costs from the development itself. And those include schools, fire and police stations, libraries, other emergency services, facilities. System development charges can only be used for capital costs, infrastructure, not for operations. A coalition formed last session that focused on allowing school districts and local communities to recover some of the costs associated with school construction that are occasioned by new development. Legislation got heard but didn't move, that coalition is reforming this session, and it's too early to say exactly what the approach will be. But since last session, that group, that session, last session, we coalition focused on schools. Since last session, there's been a sort of an independent effort that you'll probably hear about in the public safety community, and I think partly in response to some of the added needs that they had after 9/11, to allow the use of system development charges for public safety facilities. So the people that are interested in school system development charges and people interested in other ones are going to sit down together and figure out what the best approach would be. Look forward to working with you on those.
If I may follow up on this.
A
very related issue to that is the question of citing schools outside the urban growth boundaries. And there was, I think, an issue in the last legislation. I suspect we'll hear about it again. Does your organization have a position on that issue?
Mr. Chair, that's an agreement. We certainly do. Though I'm hopeful that issue has been, at least for now, resolved. We had a bill last session that we strongly opposed that would have allowed schools to be sited outside urban growth boundaries, sort of ad hoc, without any real check or balance. And we ended up at the end of the session with a compromise bill that had unanimous support. I think it had unanimous support in both houses, and there was no one on the record opposing it, which basically forces school districts and local governments to communicate better and to make sure that when development is occurring, that you're planning ahead for school sites, and that if you don't have sites, that it's possible to expand an urban growth boundary to get a site rather than to put the school outside the existing urban growth boundary. I'm still checking to see if there was a process that went on in the interim as well, several meetings to make sure that this was being implemented properly. I think there's still some level of discomfort about whether the problem is solved, and it mainly applied to high growth areas, Beaverton, Hillsborough, Bend. We've got a little bit of a breather for unfortunate reasons, that because the growth has slowed somewhat, but we certainly are very interested in the issue, and we want to take a very solution-oriented approach to that rather than a just-say-no approach. And that's, by the way, I want to say that about us in general here. We often get the image of being just against stuff. And I meant to say, the reason I distributed this little newspaper to you is that's an example of a major project we undertook to show what we're in favor of, the kind of development that we support, rather than just being against things. And certainly on the school issue, we understand the need for schools. Kids need schools. Let's just make sure that they're part of our communities and that we plan for them properly.
Any further questions, Mr. Tucker?
Thank you, Randy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It is the intent of this committee to take testimony till around 10:30 and then to adjourn. And Lori Onan, your turn in the... So I'm not quite sure we have... John and Don both have signed up to give testimony. Would you be available on Tuesday if we don't get time today, Don? Good. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you very much for inviting me here today. My name is Lori Onan. I'm the legislative liaison with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. And I apologize if I'll have some speaking problems. I have a cold, which is in my throat, so I might have to stop and clear my throat from time to time. I have handed out three handouts for you today, which are being passed out. And I wanted to take about 5 minutes or so to cover some key points about the work that Oregon Department of Environmental Quality does, how we are approaching this legislative session, and our two pieces of proposed legislation. First, the work that we do. We work with Oregon communities and businesses to protect clean water, clean air, and clean land. The legislature has given us authority and responsibility to do this work, protect clean air and clean water, to clean up toxic spills, and manage safe disposal of hazardous waste and solid waste, and promote recycling and pollution prevention. But it's important, we recognize, and I want you to understand, that we know we can't and we don't do this important work alone. Oregon communities, businesses, and citizens are partners in this work. Since this work started, they've invested millions of dollars themselves to improve pollution controls and clean up discharges. So that's an important part of how we do our work, is in partnership with folks The second thing that's important to know is that we carry out federal environmental laws in Oregon. The Federal Environmental Protection Agency, when Congress passes certain laws like the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, the Environmental Protection Agency usually carries those out, unless the state gets delegated authority to do it in place of the Environmental Protection Agency. So in Oregon, we've had a tradition of saying we want to do this work for Oregon instead of having the Federal Environmental Protection Agency do it. And that's the case with most of our programs. EPA does have oversight authority over how we carry out these laws, so they're constantly checking with us to say, are we doing it correctly? EPA also has separate enforcement authority, so you may have heard of cases from time to time where EPA comes down to the state and levies fines, and they can't do that. Is it possible for me to go get my water?
Yes.
Thank you. I left it out here. Thanks. I think I'm going to have to keep refreshing myself. Third point I want to make is that we work locally. In 1993, we decentralized our offices. At that time, most of our staff worked out of our headquarters in Portland. And what we have found since then is that having field staff in more than 15 offices around the state helps us better understand local problems and provide better service. So we've got offices in LeGrand and Pendleton and Hermiston and Roseburg and Coos Bay and North Coast, the Dalles, numerous areas around the state, and that has worked very well for us and our customers. And then finally, we are a regulatory agency. We do deal with difficult environmental problems involving businesses, local governments, and citizens. Under the leadership of DEQ's director, Stephanie Halleck, we are expected to do excellent work, be fair and equitable in how we implement and enforce regulations, and solve problems, not just run programs. So that's an important point for us. Okay, now how are we approaching this legislative session? We certainly recognize, as everybody does, the immediate challenges for Oregon's economy. We are committed to our priorities, which are protecting people's health and Oregon's environment. At the same time, we recognize that state priorities include getting Oregonians back to work and streamlining regulatory processes. So coming into the session, we said we've got three main principles. And those are, first, enhance, where we can, services that make it easier for businesses to locate and thrive in Oregon. We are seeking efficiencies and process streamlining. We've already got work underway in our programs to do that. But it's important to know that when we do that, we are not doing it to weaken environmental protections. We maintain those protections by looking at process streamlining. At the same time, there is a certain level of resources that is needed in order to be responsive to business needs and to the public. The second principle is that we want to maintain the environmental accomplishments that have protected public health and clean water, air, and land in Oregon. The overview fact sheet, which is the first page I handed out, points out that investment in this over the past 30 and more years has made our air and water cleaner. And so we believe it's important to maintain that success. And that's important not just for the environment, but for our economy as well. The third principle is that we want to keep delegation of federal regulations so the state, not the federal government, carries out federal environmental law in Oregon. And moving into our two legislative concepts, they are based on these three principles. The second page of your handout talks about Senate Bill 196, introduced in the Senate, and the goals of this legislation are to keep delegation of the federal hazardous waste program and continue our work to help small businesses understand and comply with very complex federal hazardous waste laws. First, what is hazardous waste? You may not be familiar with that. There are technical definitions in the statutes, but generally they are waste chemicals or waste products that can harm people's health and harm the environment if they are not handled safely. Take a water break here. And then, what is the hazardous waste program? Well, under federal law, there's a system of permitting and requirements for safely managing, storing, treating, and disposing of hazardous waste. Those are federal requirements. DEQ also, in keeping with our approach to provide assistance and help people understand what they need to do, we have a program that really is a state-only program to provide technical assistance to small businesses so they understand what they need to do under these laws. And we also can help them figure out ways to use different types of products that might reduce the use of chemicals and creation of hazardous waste, which can reduce regulatory requirements for them. Why do we need Senate Bill 196? There's more detail in the fact sheet. I won't go into a lot of detail. We realized that we'd have a significant fee shortfall last year coming for the 0305 biennium. So we put together a broad-based work group, including people who pay fees, businesses, environmental groups, and others, to say, okay, what should we be doing with this program in the future, and how do we pay for it? And what came out of that group was three main areas. One is, we need to work smarter. So looking at how we can do the work we're doing now with some streamlined processes, and we did come up with some things there. Increasing fees, because even if you streamline, you still need a certain amount of resources to carry out the work. So there is a proposed fee increase in here, and it's basically what's needed to keep the program, Oregon running this program. And then for the technical assistance to small businesses, that was something that they found important, but didn't want to pay fee increases to do that. So this is where I think the most controversy will be in this legislation. The group proposed taking hazardous waste penalties that DEQ levies for violations of hazardous waste law, and taking that in about $350,000 a biennium is what it is on average, and use that to support the technical assistance work. The reason this is a big issue is that money currently goes to general fund. Most penalties DEQ collects don't come to DEQ, they go to the general fund. So obviously that's a big issue. So I think there'll have to be a lot of discussion around that. The final point on this legislation is that it is a one-time fix. The reason that the fees are going down is because of Oregon's economy and problems, and so the amount of certain type of waste going to the Arlington landfill is down, and we don't necessarily see that coming back. So this gets us through 0305. We realize we have to have more discussions with all interested parties beyond that to say, how does this carry forward into the future? What other changes might need to be made? And then the last picture we hand out is what we hope will be a simple bill to get through, Senate Bill 197. It is a fee ratification of air and water fees that were approved by the legislature in DEQ's budget last session. And by law, they have to come back, because we adopted them by rule in the interim, by law they have to come back to be ratified. So no changes in these fees, they've already been set, no increases. We hope that will be a simple discussion. And keeping these fees will maintain permitting services to businesses and communities. With that, I'll stop and answer any questions that I can. And if there's anything that you want to know more about from DEQ, I'd be happy to arrange any more in-depth briefing on a particular issue or meet with you individually with the folks that are experts in those areas. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Honor. Any questions for you? Ms. Honor, Representative.
Chairman, I have a question on how civil penalties are applied. I mean, who makes the decision whether there will be civil penalties in a violation?
Mr. Chair and Representative Vice Chair Richardson, we try to figure out the simplest way. When DEQ is carrying out inspections or compliance inspections of its permits or other laws, if the violation is noted, the first thing that happens is there's a notice of noncompliance. It's just a warning. It says, we found this and you need to fix it. Depending on the violation, it may or may not be then referred to our enforcement and compliance section for further follow-up. So just the fact that you get a notice of noncompliance doesn't necessarily mean that there will be a civil penalty assessed. If it's serious enough, if it's, say, the second or third time there's been a violation, if it's something that was very dangerous, if we had talked to them before and knew they shouldn't do it and they did it anyway, those are the kind of things that often get referred to penalties. And then once it's referred to enforcement, they do the checking up to say, okay, is this a solid case? Do we have the facts? Maybe they will learn through dialogue with the company, things weren't as they appeared, and sometimes the issue can get resolved that way. The main goal we have is making sure that they are in compliance. So we're not out there to say, we're going to go after everybody and fine everybody. It's just saying we want compliance with environmental laws because that's protective. Once you get into the act number of the penalty, there's a very complex I would say that both statutorily and through our rules, there's a matrix of how the penalty is calculated with a number of factors. And if you would like more information, I can certainly get you that.
Can you ask a follow-up?
Follow-up.
Follow-up question is, if it were to be allowed that civil penalties would no longer go to the general fund but would go to technical assistance, would that not cause an inherent motivation to have more civil penalties be inflicted on the public?
Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Richardson, I think that concern is the reason that our penalties don't generally come to us. There's a concern by the people who regulate that would be the case. I would hope that's not how we would do that. That's not how we carry it out. I mean, you don't. We have a series of strict rules and policies on why things are penalized and at what level, and we would follow those and not, I don't think, go outside the boundaries of those to increase penalties because we'd be getting the funding. But that's obviously a concern, and I think there'll be some discussion about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's kind of a follow-up to Dennis's questions on collections and fines. I was reading a book where the state is owed like $1.6 billion from fines and different things from all these agencies, and we don't seem to collect the money, and I did see DEQ in there. Do you know how many uncollected fines that we have in there, and can you explain why they're still in the book and why it isn't in our pocket?
Mr. Chair, that's a very good question. A couple years ago, our director, Stephanie Alec, hired a new compliance and enforcement manager, and one of the things she's been looking at is that very question. I don't know the exact number. I can certainly get that to you. We assess penalties of perhaps, it varies, maybe $3 million a biennium. We never collect that much. There's different reasons for that. One is we oftentimes, through the process of working out a case, we'll find out facts that we didn't know and end up settling for a less amount than assessed in the first place. Secondly, there are people who can't pay. They just can't pay. Yeah. And so those don't get collected. What we want to make sure that doesn't happen is that where there is an egregious violation and the person can't afford to pay, we do need to pursue that to collection. And that's something that they're paying more attention to. And
just to follow up on that, can't the agency... Do we have to hire somebody to go collect that money, or can't? Because if we do get a collection agency, they're going to get at least 50%, or I don't know what it is, but I know it's going to be heavy. Why isn't the job of DEQ to also knock on the door and say, hey, you owe us money, and settle that thing? Why do we have to give up some of that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Zahner, that is exactly right. I think if you're going to say give it to a collection agency, you'd have to check out whether that would cost you more than you get in the first place. But that my point earlier in saying that we're paying more attention to that is we do knock on the door. We do follow up, and we're trying to make more effort to do that where the person can't afford to pay. That's something that we're working on.
Thank you, Laurie. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Bob will get to you in just a second, but I think sure. Representative Greenwood.
Mr. Chair, I have two questions, if I may. If I remember correctly, Governor Kitzhaber created an administrative rule on the reduction of persistent bioaccumulative toxins into the water system. And my assumption is that that would have something to do with you in terms of the enforcement of it. If I'm remembering correctly, and if it is there, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about about what you're doing on that issue and what needs to be done.
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlick, yes. I think it was 1999, Governor Kitzhaber created an executive order which directed us to start the process of looking at what the state might do and how we might start working on a plan to reduce what are called persistent bioaccumulative toxins by the year 2020. And I can certainly, if you don't have it, get a copy of that for you, and I don't remember it verbatim. But those chemicals are a certain list that are very toxic, such as mercury and dioxin and things like that. What we have done is we started working on mercury, and our approach is to say what types of work need to be first quantifying what the problem is in Oregon and then looking at how to work cost-effectively at what we can actually do to reduce it. So we just made a presentation for our Environmental Quality Commission, which is actually the body that adopts our rules. And I can get you a copy of what that report said, kind of what roadmap we're following. I want to make a point that we believe to get actual reductions, we have to effectively involve the stakeholders that are affected by whatever strategies we might think will work. And so that's the way we're approaching it, to be inclusive and collaborative and cost-effective in what we're looking at doing.
Let me ask a follow-up on that.
Follow.
Some of the comes not from point sources that we're used to dealing with, as I understand it, but a fair amount from off our lawns and gardens and things. I went out to my shed to see what my part was in putting certain cumulative toxins into Balch Creek, and found I was playing a role in that and took some corrective action. Is your program thinking about education and other issues in terms of dealing with the non-point source pollution?
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlick, absolutely. If you look at the pollution problems in Oregon today, a lot of our, over the past 30 and 40 years, the point sources, if you will, the pipes and the smokestacks, they've done a lot of investment in cleaning that up. But the estimate, for example, for water pollution is at about 80% statewide is from runoff of different things, urban streets and lawns and forest land and farmland, what have you. It all has an effect. And we think education is a huge part of that, because you can't approach those kind of pollution problems with the same kind of regulatory approaches that you have for the point sources. It just wouldn't work. And that is a struggle for us, and I think the way we've approached it in the past is to work with the other agencies that work with those industries and try to figure out how do we make things better, how do we adopt best management practices, how do we help people know what they need to do to help.
Thank you. And if I ask my second question, I'll yield to my colleague on the right. I think I noticed a bill. I'm having a little trouble as a freshman completely understanding every bill that comes through on the first readings.
That won't last long.
I see. I think I saw a bill that I think you've introduced on the on changes in the management of small water systems. Was that one of yours? You do manage water systems.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, you mean water supply?
I'm sorry, water supplying.
Actually, no. That DEQ does not regulate water supply. That's Department of Health Services, Oregon Health Services, Department of Human Services.
I'll ask the question in a different place then. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Representative.
I just want to follow up on the question by Representative Zarner regarding the collectability of fines. When fines are imposed by a department, is there a process in place by which they can be docketed as judgments against the offender?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackman, I would have to get back to you with a specific answer. I'm not really familiar with the details of the legal issues.
I wish you would, because I think if that could occur, it would vastly improve the collectability of judgments or fines, in that judgments then become a lien upon the property of the debtor, and it may be a way that we could work out something to enhance the collectability of fines. I'm happy to work with you and involve Representative Zarner and any legislation that might be necessary for that purpose.
I will certainly follow up with you.
Thank you.
Any further questions, Ms. Zarner? Thank you, Ms. Zarner, for
thank
coming.
You.
Unfortunately, our time that we had allotted this morning has expired, and our apologies to Mr. Beaulieu and to Don Schellenberg, but we will continue this avenue on Tuesday morning, and we certainly invite you to come back, both of you, and join us at that time.
Mr. Chair?
Representative.
Should we plan on, just for scheduling purposes, should we plan on an ongoing basis, 8:30 to 10:30 for our sessions?
I think as long as we're allowed that much, yes.
Right.
I know that at this point I think we have six bills, so we certainly want to start looking at those next week, but I think that kind of like a good book. We're learning who the characters are here, and that's not a bad influence, by the way. You're not getting it. But I'd like to follow through and get as much information from people that we know are going to be on a fairly regular basis dealing with the issues, that so that we can kind of get to know them a little bit. So, yes, we use as much. See, I'm doing the same thing. I'm taking a long time to say, yeah, we're yes, going to be here till 10:30.
I take that to be a yes.
Mr. Chair, could I make one final comment?
Certainly.
I think as a final goal in our committee, at the end of our hard work and after the session, we need to see Ross Day and Randy Tucker sitting up here with holding hands. And then if that happens at the end of our session, and maybe Don can join them, and I think we will have accomplished our work.
Thank you. Kumbaya, that's right.
We have contentious issues in front of us, and obviously that's one of them. So thank you all for this morning, and this meeting is adjourned until 8:30 Tuesday morning.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It does.
Yeah.